I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Arthur Lopez. He is an artist and he's curator of the show The Fine Folk of New Mexico, People, Places, and Culture Through Art, which opens on October 26th and runs for the rest of the year, actually well into January. And Rod Lambert, who's the gallery director at the Community Gallery, which is at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center, and Terry Greaves, who is an artist, one of the many artists in this show. Welcome, everybody, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
So how did this show come into being, The Fine Folk of New Mexico?
We were having a meeting down at the Community Gallery. I was on the Community Gallery Advisory Committee, and we were just talking about shows and how we could put on something with the caliber of artists that are in the show and what we could do to, you know, just brainstorming really is how it started. And I came up with the idea of, a play on words, which is The Fine Folk of New Mexico. And it's talking about how fine art, folk art, you know, where's that fine line? And we started just kind of throwing things together and figured, you know, New Mexico has so many great artists in it that let's see what we can do about putting it together and really, showcasing that. And, the whole committee, Rod and everybody was on board. So we decided to come up with this plan, got a group of artists together and applied for a grant from the NEA.
And you got this grant and the rest is history.
Exactly. I think the NEA, when they were approaching, or when we were sending in our application 2 years ago, our application wasn't lacking any kind of national, academic, artistic significance. And so as a result of putting Arthur in on this show and having a local artist curate the show and utilize his connections in the community, it was much easier to end up getting, you know, this really high-caliber exhibit that I think people on the East Coast who often have this stereotypical cliched perspective on what Santa Fe and New Mexico is, they were still able to understand it, and yet we didn't end up falling into the traps of being, you know, coyotes and bandanas. So it was good.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think, you know, to the show, because it focuses on how New Mexico has influenced artists for generations, you know, all the way back from, you know, the Taos Society to the Santa Fe Society, George O'Keefe, and what has attracted all of these artists to New Mexico and how it influences them and their art. You know, there's artists in this show from all over the country, but now reside here in Santa Fe. And I think a lot of your place, and where you reside, reflects also back into your work. It's like your environment, your community, you know, the people around you, and you see that in the work itself and with the culture around you. And you know, the show has kind of tried to emphasize that also. And you see how unique it all is. And also how New Mexico is a tricultural state with the Native American, the Anglo, and the Hispanics.
At the very least, tricultural.
Exactly. So the cool thing, too, is that with the caliber of these artists, you'll see in the show how it all just flows together. You know, it's not in one, you know, section. Like, we haven't set it up as the Native American spot, the Hispanic spot, and the Anglo spot. It's immersed throughout the show so that when you walk through, you can't even tell whose work is who without a name attached to it or a stigma or a, you know, that classification itself. And it's kind of cool just to see that good art is good art regardless of who made it.
Well, and Terry came in to drop off her work, and I was describing to her how Arthur and I were setting it up, so it was kind of open that way, and we didn't want to categorize. And I think Terry's response was,
"That's great, because that's how we live together. We live together, intermingled communities, and our art and our ways of communicating with each other, which is what we do with art, doesn't have those delineations that art historians put."
Exactly.
And so when they talk about this show being kind of across the board craft and fine, those are kind of definitions that don't apply to most of the artists that I know as my peers. Because we move, our communities are so important to us. Our living in those communities are so important to us. We are often, our purpose, or at least my purpose, and I'll talk for myself, is to communicate to the larger world. And my world, myself, my experience, my history, my family history and all of that is mixed. I'm American. For better or worse, I am an American. And I think that when you look at art and you see that it crosses over craft, it crosses over fine art, that it interplays and intermingles with each other, it's much like our culture here. This is one of the most diverse places I've lived, and I lived in California for a long time. And we communicate with each other, not just through our art, but in just in everyday life, and I appreciate that. I mean, we're mingled together in the show the way that we mingle together in life.
And I think art is always just a range of influences. I mean,
absolutely.
Everybody gets influenced by everybody else, and the idea that you can, as you say, art historians sometimes do, classify into one kind of category or another. What was that great quote? I keep remembering it. An abstract expressionist said, art criticism to me is what ornithology is to the birds.
Yes, exactly. It has absolutely no meaning to the birds.
And I think that was part of the early on when Arthur and I were going through and trying to slug out what exactly it was that this show was going to be. I think we were fighting with this need to classify it. And I think eventually both of us just let it go and be like, we're not going to define it that finely. We don't need to. This, once we get it in, we'll know. And we do.
Exactly. And I think that's where the title of the show itself kind of defines it very loosely, you know, and depending on how you look at it, the fine folk, you know, can talk about the work itself, the art, or it can talk about the people.
The terrific people of New Mexico. That was my first reading of it.
Exactly.
And I think also when you take the attitude that all three of you are taking, which is that we are a large community with lots of subcultures but lots of intermingling, you kind of get past, at least for the moment, the kind of focus on colonialism and co-optation and all those kinds of things that people, you know, for good reason have complained about. But guess what? In art circles, it's fine for us to all influence and give and take in whatever ways we want.
It's a way of processing our lives today. I mean, basically what I do when I make a piece of work is I can only see it from my perspective. Now, maybe other artists do it differently, but I can only see it through my lens. And other artists can only see it through their lenses, and we are better people by seeing the world through their lenses, by opening ourselves up to what they might have to say about the Pueblo Revolt, or what they might have to say about pride in the conquistadores, you know? I mean, there's two sides to that story.
Right.
And they're both valid. And art gives us a chance to be able to see those two sides.
We're talking about the exhibition, The Fine Folk of New Mexico, which I love it. It's presented by the city of Santa Fe. It's a terrific thing.
This isn't your mother's arts commission.
Well, basically the community gallery is something that people might walk past and not realize how much great stuff is going in there.
Yeah, well, we've been around 4 years, and I think a lot of the people that come into the gallery are often accidental visitors initially, but our mission and vision from the very beginning was to offer a location for local artists to promote, exhibit, and sell their work, and that's been the hard, concrete mission that we have unwaveringly followed from the very beginning. And this show, I think oftentimes we've included in our shows the full range of artists, from those who are represented by local galleries who are nationally known, all the way down to people who may be absolute beginners whose portfolio really sparked the advisory committee in a new way. But I think this show, specifically since as a result of the NAA funding, is a tribute to the high caliber artists who are here, either, you know, born or delivered later to this location. And I think their participation in the show is a testament to the kind of community feel that happens between artists in this town.
So let's talk about each one of you, some of the specific work. I mean, Terry Greaves, you are an artist and you work, among other things, a lot with beads. Tell us about your beading work, where it came from, what you're doing with it now.
So I started off as a traditional bead worker making traditional objects, moccasins, traditional style of purses, all the kind of accoutrements that go with traditional native life or in our ceremonial life or, you know, in decoration, in everyday decoration. After I graduated from college, I came here to Santa Fe, and I went to Indian Market. In my second year, I won their big award over there, and I won it specifically with a piece that was non-traditional. It was a beaded umbrella.
Oh, interesting.
And that piece, though I'd already been making other non-traditional objects, that piece was a major breakthrough to me because I realized that I was not beholden to the traditional object. Now, within our native communities, there is a right way and a wrong way to do art, to do ceremonial object or to do objects that are used. And I didn't want to cross the bounds of what was improper. And when I made that umbrella, I made it as, I didn't even think about what I was doing when I was making it. I just fell out of me. I made it. And afterwards, I realized that I could express not only myself personally, but I could tell stories, these kind of narratives of a modern day 21st century Native life, and I could use object to help me tell that story. So from that piece, that particular piece, I now feel or have felt unbound by the object, so that the object becomes a part of the narrative that I'm telling, and it's not the basis for the narrative that I'm telling.
It's a liberation.
Yes, it was. It was a massive liberation for me to be able to do that. And also the beadwork, the type of beadwork I do, is predominantly pictorial. Kiowas do not traditionally do pictorial beadwork. We do abstract geometric. And so from the get-go, I was kind of doing not my traditional beadwork. So where it's led to me today, I have gone completely non-utilitarian I still do utilitarian objects, but I've gone almost completely non-utilitarian, and now almost look at my beads as just the medium that I need to tell the narrative.
What are some of the non-utilitarian objects you're talking about?
Well, unfortunately, the two pieces that I have in the show are both utilitarian, so are based on utilitarian objects. The main piece that I have in there is called Prayer Blanket, and it's a blanket. It hangs on the wall. It's not actually a blanket. Like, I don't think you could use it as a blanket, but it has it basically tells the story of why Native people enlist in the U.S. Armed Services in higher numbers than any majority or minority in the United States. We enlist that in those high numbers per capita because this is our homeland. And many of us come from warrior societies. I specifically come from a warrior society. And so I did the piece when everything hit the fan in Fallujah. And I was trying to understand. I had been home and I had seen new inductees into our warrior society, and I'm like, why are these guys going over there? Like, I'm trying to wrap my brain around this because I come from a kind of politicized, like, you know, the colonial power, and why are we fighting for their oil underneath the Arab sands and all of that. Like, it resonated with me in terms of the oil that was taken out of Oklahoma. The oil that's continued. Now, gas fracking is big in Oklahoma on Native lands. And so I was just trying to understand what all of that was. And so that piece specifically came out of, and I think it's appropriate now that we're winding down the war, my children... Both of my children have not known 1 year without war in their life. That is a amazing and horrifying thing at the same time. And yet we manage to deal with it in our own communities, whether it's Native or Hispanic or Anglo or any other community. We manage to deal with these people coming home. Specifically among Native people in traditional communities, we have a way of bringing these people back into our community so that they can process what they've gone through and come back, maybe not whole, but okay, into their families and into the tribe. And I thought that was a really important thing to talk about, specifically when such horrible things were happening overseas.
And your brothers and sisters are experiencing and taking part in those horrible things.
Absolutely. Every community, every Native community has men and women serving. And whether they're serving in Afghanistan now or they were serving in Iraq before or in some place else on an aircraft carrier or whatever, you know, they are a part of that large war machine. And how do they process that? How do you come home and know that you're fighting for the colonial power that, you know, two or three generations ago for us, it wasn't so long ago, my great-grandmother was dancing the ghost dance to make white people go away when she was like 16 years old. I have sons that look at military service, even though they're young, as an honorable thing. That is something I have to come to terms with in my own head as a person, as a mother, and as a Kiowa person. And how do I do that? And the only way that I can do that is by working it out in my artwork. And so that particular piece was my way of processing the pride and the dignity that we feel for our returning men and women. And they are inducted into this very elite society, and we honor them regardless of the politics. We honor their service. And that is a very clear distinction that's made every time that we go to those ceremonies, that the human being isn't lost in the politics. And I think that that's a really big distinction to make.
Well, I think it indicates that the culture, as well as a history of warriors, has this, you know, ritual and this policy in place that deals with that. And yes. I don't think necessarily the Anglo culture, certainly the U.S. military, aren't.
You know, PTSD, people coming home with all kinds of problems that maybe they aren't wearing on their physical body. And this piece, I actually specifically talk about that. I split the piece into two levels. There's the celestial and the terrestrial. The celestial, and both signs have medicine signs on them, buffalo medicine, which is specific among Kiowa people for war wounds. And I put that anchors it on either side of the blanket, because the soldiers and the people that are dancing through the center of the blanket need that medicine in the here and now, and in the point when they go on. That medicine is going to help them make that transition.
So the piece is an artwork that's hanging in the Santa Fe Community Gallery, and it's also itself a ceremonial object.
I don't think of it as a ceremonial object at all. I think of it as a point, like, it is, how do I explain it? It is my physical expression, all right? And I think that, yes, in, like, when you go to ceremonial dances or you hear songs and stuff like that, those are physical expressions, right? And I feel like in making that piece, it was a physical expression of mine to help heal, a prayer.
Right.
Specifically, a prayer for peace, a prayer that there is peace among these people who've had to go through this, and those of us on this side of them, of bringing them back into us, to a prayer for that, a prayer for that kind of peace.
Right. We're talking to artist Terry Greaves. Let's turn for a moment to Arthur Lopez, who is an artist and curator of the show The Fine Folk of New Mexico. Now, you are a santero, and santero is a term here that means a specific thing here in New Mexico.
Yeah, loosely. I think that for myself, I consider myself more of a, you know, a sculptor and a wood sculptor than a santero that does kind of santero art. I truly believe, you know, in the tradition of things, but, you know, the tradition of the Hispanic tradition of bulto making or santero work, I use that tradition to honor the tradition, but I create contemporary work. And more of the santero work is done mainly out of religious beliefs and religious purposes. And so that's why I really don't consider myself a santero, because I don't make it specifically for those religious ideas as much as I do for artwork.
Right.
And so I think that's where the line is for me. I mean, I have done pieces for churches and for religious purposes, and those pieces I do consider religious or spiritual. And that's why, you know, I have that little classification of santero work and as a sculptor.
But I think it's the same conflict that you face as Terry did as well. There is this, you know, traditional bound by these techniques and this, you know, history.
Exactly.
And Arthur and Terry both are fine examples, and as are most
of
the show.
And I think that's what's part of the show, is that you can honor your traditions by using the methods and materials that you were taught through your ancestors or through, you know, the community, through generations of that knowledge, and yet we express it in a more contemporary way. So we're still honoring that tradition, but we're using it in a modern or contemporary way to express ourselves and the things that we are going through now, because everything is different from, you know, the generations past.
I don't know if you feel this, but I feel no matter how contemporary the object is, and non-traditional in form and all of that, I feel the voices of those that came before me that brought this technique to me.
Exactly.
What I do with it is my own, but they brought this through time to me.
Exactly.
And I feel that pull right on through to what I do.
I agree. I think that's why I like to honor, I'm a strong believer that you can still use traditional methods to create contemporary work. Mm-hmm. I still use all those traditional methods while I create my work, because I don't have to, use the new contemporary,
tools
or things like that. I mean, although I do, but I still honor with using some of the traditional methods and things like that.
How are you taught?
I'm self-taught with a lot of learning. When I started, I did a lot of research in the Museum of International Folk Art. I went to as many museums as I could, went into the archives. I read about it. I studied it. I went down to Spanish Market. I talked to the people that were involved there, and I asked a lot of questions. I went and talked to some of the other people doing this and asked them, how do you do this? How does this happen? And some were willing to share, and I was fortunate in that way. And the rest of it, was self-taught through the education process of going through research.
Did you ever have a specific mentor?
I think I admired many of the artists. I had a specific, David Navod Lucero helped me with a lot of my gessoing, my encouragement. He showed me the proper tools, gave me some of the knives. He led me on that path. But one of the best things that he told me is, I can't carve this thing for you. You have to do it. So he'd have me, take it home and do it. And that was a great lesson to learn, because, I couldn't sit there and have him show me all the steps along the way. And it helped me become a better artist, because I wasn't mimicking or copying him or any other artist. I began to develop my own style, and that's what helped to kind of get me to where I am today, I think. It's that whole process, the learning process of, you fall down and you got to pick yourself up.
Now, what do the saints, the traditional saints who we see in every church, what do they mean to you? What do they mean to our community today?
Again, it goes back to that, how you look at them and how you perceive them. In the religious form, I think that they're a spiritual filling for each person. When I was growing up, I was an altar boy, and I would go to the Catholic church, and I'd look around, and I was terrified of these crucifixes and all these images staring back at you, blood coming down the crucifix. It was frightening. And now that I've become an artist, I don't look at it that way. I look at it again, and I tell people to look at it again. I have a crucifix collection with probably over 50 crucifixes hanging in our home. And when you look at it again, you can see the design work in it. You could see the artistic value in it. A lot of times I tell people, the example that I give is between the Native American Kachinas and the Hispanic. A lot of Anglos or other collectors, it's easy for them to collect a Kachina because they don't have a direct connection as a person with it. And although it is a spiritual object to the Native Americans, whether it's, the eagle or the different gong dancers or what have you, that's a spiritual image to them, but people have a disconnect because it's not someone that they can recognize with. So when you look at a religious item now that a Santero or an artist, sculptor creates at Spanish Market, I ask people to look at it as artwork first. And, I did have a lot of collectors. One of my biggest collectors was Jewish, and he collected crucifixes. And, he would say my Jewish mother would roll over in her grave if she knew I had these. But he was able to separate the difference between the religion and the artwork. And I think that's a good thing that you can do, is separate it. And I think it goes a long ways to, within your own culture, is how you perceive it and let others perceive it as well.
The show is called The Fine Folk of New Mexico, People, Places, and Culture Through Art. It opens this Friday, the 26th of October, at the Santa Fe Community Gallery, which is on West Marcy Street. It's right by the Santa Fe Convention Center. It's part of the Santa Fe Community Convention Center. It's from 5 to 7, and a lot of the artists who are in the show will be there. Is that correct?
That is.
we're going to have unprecedented visitors.
Yeah, it's awesome. There's about 30 of, I'd like to say only some of the best artists in New Mexico, because unfortunately, you know, I'm probably going to have a lot of my friends mad at me because I couldn't invite all of the artists that I would have liked to.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's so many great artists in this state. But, yeah, we're going to have at least 30 of the best artists, and hopefully most of them will be there as well. As,
well, and you'll have their friends and family and their collectors.
And everybody listening to the show right now.
Everybody listening today.
Exactly. And there's also hopefully going to be a little lowrider preview outside. We've arranged for about 6 lowriders to come up and be on display outside, just for another little eye candy for people to
another kind
and
of
space,
art.
More space outside than there is in the gallery, so it gives them something to do while they're trying to funnel through.
Mm-hmm. I mean, our openings are historically well attended, but I think this one's going to be even larger.
Well, I want to thank you all for being here. Rod Lambert is gallery director. Terry Greaves is an artist. Arthur Lopez is artist and curator of this show. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Najwan Darwish. He is a Palestinian poet. His work has been translated into many languages, and he is a resident right now at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary.
And Katie Avery is with us. She works at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and Najwan is part of Open Studios, which is happening tomorrow night.
Yes. Tomorrow night at 5:30, we will be hosting our Open Studios event at the Santa Fe Art Institute, which will feature all 10 of our artists and writers in residence, Najwan being one of them.
And Open Studios are always wonderful events that the public is invited to, and is great fun and really interesting.
And they're free.
And they're free, and there's even refreshments. So I was thinking, because your poetry is wonderful and very powerful, maybe we could start with your reading a poem in Arabic. I'll read the translation in English, and we can go on from there.
Okay. باص الكوابيس رأيتهم يضعون خالاتي في أكياس بلاستيك سوداء وفي زوايا الأكياس تتجمع دماؤهن الحارة لكن أنا ليس لي خالات عرفت أنهم قد قتلوا نتاشا ابنتي التي في الثالثة لكن أنا ليس لي ابنة قيل لي إنهم اغتصبوا زوجتي قبل أن يجروا جسمها على الدرج ويتركوه في الشارع لكن أنا لم أتزوج لا شك هذه نظارة التي تحطمت تحت البسطار لكن أنا لا ألبس نظارة كنت نائما في بيت والدي أحلم بالسفر إلى بيتها وحين استيقظت رأيت إخوتي يتدلون من سقف كنيسة القيامة كان الرب يقول من الشفقة هذا ألمي أنا وكنت أستجمع كبرياء المعلقين وأقول لا بل هذا ألمنا الألم يضيء ويصير أحب إلي من كوابيسي لن أهرب للشمال أيها الرب لا تحسبني من الذين يبحثون عن ملاذ سنكمل لاحقا هذا الحساب علي أن أمضي الآن إلى النوم لا أريد أن أتأخر عن باص الكوابيس الذاهب إلى صبرا وشتيلة.
And the poem is called The Nightmare Bus. I saw them stuff my aunts into plastic sacks. Their hot blood pooled in the corners of the bags. But I have no aunts. I knew they had killed Natasha, my 3-year-old daughter. But I have no daughter. I was told they raped my wife, then dragged her body down the stairs and left it lying on the street. But I am not married. Those are certainly my glasses that were crushed under their boots, but I don't wear glasses. I slept in my parents' house, and I was dreaming about her house. When I awoke, my brothers hung from the roof of the Church of the Resurrection. Out of compassion, the Lord said, "This is my own suffering." I mustered up the hanged men's pride and said, in my opinion, it's ours. Pain illuminates everything, and I love it more than my nightmares. I will not flee to the north. O Lord, don't count me among the ones seeking shelter. We'll continue this report later. I've got to go sleep now. I don't want to miss the nightmare bus that goes to Sabra and Shatila. We're talking to poet Najwan Darwish, and I think when I read your poem, when I think of poets from places that are going through such difficult times, I mean, you were born and raised in Jerusalem, you're Palestinian, that there's a lot more at stake when you write poetry than for, say, an American who is writing about their garden or something like this. You are engaged politically. You are engaged with the people around you. Do you experience it that way?
Not necessary. It's not necessary to be born in a war zone to be politically engaged. If you are a good writer, you could be engaged even if you are born in Switzerland. So it's about the awareness. What kind of awareness do you have to the place you are in, to the history you are in? In this place, there is no peaceful, there is no country which could say that it has peace and peaceful history. We all living in a contested earth.
So, how did you become a poet? How did you start writing?
You know, I never thought of this question. But I think, you know, one of the first things I wrote against my teachers in school. So, you know, like mocking the teachers. This was the beginning. And I think also it was part of it, a kind of reflection against the Israeli occupation we are living under. So I think the harsh experiences in childhood with occupation, they were like a sort of motivation. But later on, you would be interested in poetry as art, despite of the motivation. So
right.
You would be obsessed with the art of poetry.
Even as you're dealing with the same material.
Yes, despite of the material. They always say material in poetry is not the issue. Of course, it's important what you are saying and what you have to say. But the more important, how you say it.
You think that's more important?
Yes. Because the things we are saying, somehow they are sort of public knowledge. But what's special, how we say them in art. So the issue is to be a good artist in the beginning.
Now, what was your childhood like in Jerusalem?
Nothing special, like any Palestinian who would grow up under the occupation. It's unusual. You would be faced every day with a sort of military occupation, with a lot of details which are not very pleasant.
How did it affect your life as a child going to school every day, for example?
To be honest with you, I'm not a big fan of talking about suffering. I'm always facing these things and I'm passing. I'm not stopping much to remember. Sometimes when I do remember things, I do write them as poems.
Would you like to read another poem? Do you want to read one in English?
In English? Okay, I will try with one. Even my English is not beautiful. And before we were doing the interview, I was saying to myself, oh my God, you are doing an interview in English. This would be horrible to the listeners. But I remembered once listening to an interview with the Spanish artist Salvador Dali. And his English is very terrible. And he was brave enough to make an interview in English. So I said to myself, I won't be worse than Dali. So this poem called Reserved. Once I tried to sit on one of the vacant seats of hope. But the word reserved was squatting there like a hyena. I did not sit down. No one sat down. The seats of hope are always reserved.
Poetry of Najwan Darwish. So, I mean, it is interesting and I think important for people to hear and understand that you don't like to talk directly about what you experience because you don't like to talk about suffering. And it comes out in your poems in so many ways. When you write a poem and you feel that you have brought the craft to the highest level that you are able to and the poem is complete, does that transform your suffering in any way?
In a way, you would feel a kind of satisfaction that you made it into a piece of art. And that art itself has a power to move. So when I would see, for example, this poem, The Nightmare Bus to Sabra and Shatila, is reaching people from different languages and different cultures, I would feel that at least I did a small thing to the victim of this massacre, which the poem is talking about, which is the famous massacre of Sabra and Shatila, which happened in Lebanon during the Israeli invasion to the capital of Lebanon in 1982. So it would give you a feeling that you could speak for voiceless victims. Not just for my people, for Palestinians. I think my work concerned with injustice all over the world.
I went to the reading the other night. There was a reading downtown where you and other residents of the Santa Fe Art Institute were reading your work, and it seemed like there was a deep understanding that it's not just that you Palestinians are the victims that permeates your work.
This is true. First, it's how to deal with victimhood. On a personal level, I never look at myself as a victim, and I am sometimes critical to the victim attitude, even if there is a huge injustice on me as a Palestinian. But injustice is a universal phenomena, and this is how we deal with it. And injustice against a nation or a people or even a one person is against everyone. This is how I see injustice.
When you look at what Palestinians are going through now, I mean, when I read some of the articles that I read in the paper of what's happening now, the young teenagers being beaten up sort of mob style, it reminds me so much of the Jim Crow period in the United States, you know, what Southern black people endured over such a long period of time.
It seems that always we could find these similarity. It seems that injustice has the same nature, and colonialism sometimes has the same nature. In Palestine, we are living under occupation for more than 6 decades. We are living under occupation. And it's a huge injustice. I think it's one of the rare models where you could find direct military occupation with an apartheid system, with wall, with whatever you want to see, you could see in Palestine nowadays.
So let's read another poem now, and we're going to do it the opposite way now. I'm going to read it in English, and you'll read it in Arabic. We're talking to poet Najwan Darwish. The poem is called Earl Grey. The women who sowed and harvested the tea to be packaged in Earl Grey boxes, do they forgive me when I drink the torments of 300 years in a single cup of tea? Do they forgive me, my sisters who were sold for $200 in the cities of salt? Earl Grey, no one mentions the names of the women who died in the fields. Earl Grey, no one knows the names of those who are sold in the cities of salt. Massive ships sailing on God's tears, transporting the colony's pain. This is the tea of Asia's daughters. You, Earl Thief, you, pirate.
اللواتي غرسنا الشاي وقطفنه ليعلب في صناديق إيرل جراي. هل يسامحنني حين أشرب عذابات 300 سنة في كأس شاي؟ هل يسامحنني شقيقاتي المباعات $200 في مدن الملح؟ إيرل جراي لا أحد يذكر أسماء اللواتي متن في الحقول. إيرل جراي لا أحد يعرف أسماء اللواتي يبعن في مدن الملح. سفن ضخمة تبحر في دموع الرب وهي تنقل ألم المستعمرات. هذا شاي بنات آسيا أيها الإيرل اللص أيها القرصان.
Let's talk for a moment about translation. I'm looking at all these poems that you've written, and each one translated by a different person and sometimes by a couple of different people. How do you work with translators and to really get the translation that you feel expresses the Arabic in English in other languages?
Maybe first we have to mention the translators of the poems we were reading. The first one, The Nightmare Bus, was translated by Marlon Hacker, the great American poet and translator, with Antoine Joki, my translator into French.
And you have a beautiful, slim volume of poetry translated into French. I think it's a bilingual edition.
Yes, yeah. It translated by Antoine Joki, who's one of the finest translators of Arabic poetry into French. The other poem, Early Grey, was translated by poet Andrew Nance. He's a poet living now in Iowa City. And for example, Reserved was translated by marvelous translator Karim James Abu Zaid from Berkeley. All of them were doing great job in translation. I think sometimes I am receiving sort of good comments on the poetry, and so I always would say these are the translators.
The translators of poetry have to be incredibly sensitive, and they have to be really poets themselves.
Yeah, and I think I'm quite lucky with my translators into English.
What are you doing at the Santa Fe Art Institute? What are you working on?
I'm sleeping there. I'm working on my new collection in Arabic. So I'm trying to finish it. And it's under the title, When Other Invaders Come. This is the manuscript I'm working on now at Santa Fe.
When you are back home, when you're in Jerusalem, how do you work with your poetry? Do you give readings? Do you teach? What's your life like?
I'm sleeping much. I spent part of my life sleeping at the daytime and waking up at night. At night, everyone is sleeping in Jerusalem, so in many nights I would be the only one who's awake in the city.
And you're just working?
Yes, I'm just working. I'm writing much, and I'm publishing much. I'm not very much involved in the social life.
Do you have contact with your readers?
I have to say, many of my readers are in the Arab world, which we don't have much physical contact with. In Palestine, we live, because of the occupation, under a kind of isolation. So Arabs from all the Arab countries, which do read my language and which I also do read them, they can't come to Palestine. And it's also difficult for us to go to the Arab countries. So I am somehow cut in from my surrounding culture.
Are you in contact through email? I mean,
yeah, through publishing mainly, because my work is most of the time published in the Arab world in magazines and newspapers and so.
We've got time for another poem. Do you want to read the poem Jerusalem?
Yes.
Well,
please.
Let's see. So maybe I'll just read it in English.
Yes.
Okay. Jerusalem. When I leave you, I turn to stone, and when I come back, I turn to stone. I name you Medusa. I name you the older sister of Sodom and Gomorrah, you baptismal basin that burned Rome. The murdered hum their poems on the hills, and the rebels reproach the tellers of their stories. When I leave the sea behind and come back to you, come back by this small river that flows in your despair, I hear the reciters of the Quran and the shrouders of corpses. I hear the dust of the condolers. I am not yet 30, but you buried me time and again, and each time for your sake I emerge from the earth. So let those who sing your praises go to hell, those who sell souvenirs of your pain, and those who are standing with me now. In the picture, I name you Medusa. I name you the older sister of Sodom and Gomorrah, you baptismal basin that still burns. When I leave you, I turn to stone. When I come back, I turn to stone. And tell us about the translator of this poem.
He's Karim James Abu Zaid, who's now working on a selected poems of my work, which would be published in 2014. Through New York Review Books. So Karim is really one of the most sensitive translators I ever work with. And he's always shocks me with his choices and with the very good choices. And I always ask him, Karim, you should be writing poetry secretly. So he laughs. And
they
say, no, my friends do write poetry, I don't. But he's very sensitive with linguistic choices. He would always find the equivalence of, not just of the words, of the whole poetic craft.
Now, are you actively part of peace movements or activist movements yourself?
Not with peace movements, because I have so much a critic toward peace movements, because in many times we call them peace business.
What do you mean?
I mean that a lot of the word peace is a beautiful slogan, but in the reality, there is a lot of injustice hidden under the slogan of peace. So you could support the Israeli occupation by saying that I am a peace activist. But in the reality, as a peace activist, you should ask yourself whom you are helping, whom you are covering through this peace activism.
Do you think there is no legitimate and true peace activism?
Not really. But in the last two decades, at least in Palestine, the whole concept of the peace process was somehow fake and corrupt. I'm talking specifically about Palestine. So the peace process of the Middle East is a big lie. Is a big lie and an unpleasant joke.
Do you envision a real peace process?
No, not really. Not really. This peace process, I think that in general, peace is a fruit of justice. But what they were trying to implement with the so-called peace process, a kind of peace with injustice together, which doesn't work in my opinion.
Okay, but then is there a justice movement that you feel you are part of or that you are taking active part in?
Most of the time, I would try to be in any efforts toward justice, toward anti-colonialism, anti-occupation. Anything would be anti-occupation, I would be under it, automatically.
At this point, it's such a... For outside observers like me, and I'm not heavily involved in this issue particularly, it seems like we're in a kind of hopeless moment.
Somehow, very true, yeah. We are living in a dark moment, and not just in Palestine. I think internationally, we are living in a sort of dark ages, but they are unacknowledged dark ages. Everyone is acting like we are living in a beautiful era, democracy era. No, we are living in a black era. And there is a lot of fascism around the world, and I could mention a lot of fascist countries about around the world. But the issue that they are not very aware of themselves as fascist countries, and we are not very aware about our age as a dark age. But I have no doubts that we are living now in new dark ages.
Is there anything that gives you hope?
Life itself. Life itself. You, in the moment you are living, you are, and the struggle is a kind of hope. And despite of these dark ages, I am happy that I'm living in them, despite of the darkness. And I think we all, what we can do is to face this darkness and to work against it somehow.
Najwan Darwish is a Palestinian poet in residence at the Santa Fe Art Institute. A collection of his poetry will be available in a couple of years, and if I'm still sitting here, we will get you back on the air. And Katie Avery, tell us once again about the Open Studios tomorrow night.
So tomorrow at Open Studios, we will also be selling the Beirut 39 anthology, which Najwan is featured in. And I should point out that his residency is a special fee-free residency sponsored through the Alliance for Artist Communities. And we are one of 23 artist residency programs that have been hosting the Beirut 39 writers.
And that's the idea that Najwan is one of the 39 best Arab writers under the age of 40, which is what this anthology is about. So once again, what time should people be at the Santa Fe Art Institute?
Open Studio starts at 5:30 tomorrow evening.
Well, we will see you there, Najwan and Katie. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, thank you. Mary. Thanks.